question ultimately is, you know, where do we go from here? I mean, where do we go from here?
OTB Sports Radio.
I drunk texted Joe Smith, too small Latin Hebra. And he obviously just threw it into like Google Translate or something, because he's like, ha, thanks, Danny. Yeah, the first half was good, actually.
Now broadcasting 24 hours a day, live on the Go Loud app, Alexa.
You have a whole new world of possibilities.
Google Home, tune in, and offtheball.com/radio.
This is OTB Sports Radio.
The Off The Ball Podcast Network.
The Sunday Papers on Off The Ball.
Now you're welcome back. So as ever around this time of a Sunday, we're looking through the back pages and the Sunday papers. We have headlines firstly for you, and we'll start with the Sunday World. Mane happy returns. This is Sadio Mane, who came off the bench yesterday at Carrow Road. It was windy, it was miserable. The Sunday World here describes Liverpool as a bit sluggish, but Mane's goal was quite brilliant. So Liverpool are a whopping, they say, 25 points clear, which is a bit surreal. Even Jurgen Klopp afterwards was saying it's hard to make sense of it. Over on the left-hand side, City fear mass exodus, as you might imagine. It would seem that Raheem Sterling, Kevin De Bruyne and Emerick Laporte will lead the mass exodus if the two-year ban from the Champions League is upheld. Sterling, they want to sign a £450,000 per week contract to keep him at the club till 2025. That deal won't go ahead if City are not cleared. And then De Bruyne and Laporte, they say, are both on over £300,000 a week as well. And that could become just too crippling for the club to pay under the circumstances if things don't go well for them in the summertime when they appeal the UEFA ruling. Next, Sunday Mirror Sport. This is not Armageddon, with a picture of Pep looking as if it is Armageddon. City convinced evidence will put them in the clear and overturn ban. They say here, a source of the club, we're convinced that when we put our evidence before CAS, we will see this decision overturned. And then a story we'll come to in a moment, Euro loss and I'll go. This is Mick McCarthy. He was in Dublin during the week, spoke to Sunday journalists as well, and certainly clarified what he will do for the June friendlies should Ireland fail to qualify for Euro 2020. Mick's contract runs up until July, but he does not intend on hanging around for the three friendlies in June if Ireland are not at the Euros. The Star then, Flog Pog. Club decides it's Paul over and will use £130 million to fund transfers for midfield duo. This is in a few of the papers. Mino Raiola, Pogba's agent, has said that he is talking to Juventus about Pogba. United say they're looking for 130 million sterling, and so they're inching closer together, Pogba and Juventus. Sun Sport then, it's a picture of the Manchester City crest cracking. Real step up Sterling chase, so it would seem Real Madrid will launch an all-out assault to land Raheem Sterling, says Martin Lipton. They were already planning a swoop for Sterling during the summer, it seems, rated at £180 million. And then over here, players back for crisis summit. As you can imagine, the Manchester City players got back from their winter break and immediately had a summit with Ferran Soriano at the club, and he tried to reassure them things were going to be okay. Sunday Independent then, making a splash picture from the Leinster game yesterday against the Cheetahs. Leinster won, almost needless to say at this stage, 36 points to 12. There is rain everywhere, so it's a good picture. And beneath that, John Green, GAA boards tackle €100 million debt. We'll come to lots of GAA financial stories in the paper today. So the GAA county boards are carrying debts of €100 million, the Sunday Independent can reveal, but almost one third of that is being shouldered by Cork. And it showed an analysis of 30 of 32 county boards, Derry and Antrim accounts not available, show that the majority of county boards are in rude health despite the mountain of debt. So they're servicing the debt quite well. The Mail on Sunday then, picture of Sadio Mane sealed with a kiss. He's blown a kiss to somebody. Mane on the mark, Reds move 25 points clear. And then Big Mick promises to walk if playoffs are a flop. Again, that's Mick McCarthy talking to the Sunday journalists during the week. Sunday Times, finally we have, excuse me as I drop that, we have Pep Guardiola. Picture of him with the Premier League trophy, happier times. Death of the Dream, Jonathan Northcroft and David Walsh and Rod Little on the shaming of Manchester City is their lead picture. We have Mick McCarthy here. Deal for Keane was news to me. This is Robbie Keane's deal, which was a four-year deal. So Robbie Keane's future under Stephen Kenny is very much TBC. And then beneath the Manchester City picture, there are bylines such as major rivals circle around City stars And Guardiola has Juventus exit option. It would seem Juventus have already been in touch with Guardiola and said, whenever you're ready, call us. You're more than welcome. Now, we have in studio Mark Gallagher from the Irish Daily Mail and the Mail on Sunday, and Cliona Foley, a journalist and presenter as well of the Off the Bench podcast. You're both very welcome. Lots of money being discussed today. Money.
It's just like we're actually reviewing the business pages today, really, not the sports pages at all, which is a little bit depressing.
On Mick McCarthy, seen as he's in all the back pages, just a few things. I mean, the news line is that, and it's not a massive surprise, I would think, if they don't qualify for the Euros, even though he's contracted up until July, what would be the point in me sticking around for the friendlies in June? That's no great surprise. And then also Robbie Keane and his contract extending beyond Mick was news to him. And he's not too sure where Robbie fits into Stephen Kenny's plans.
Yeah, and it's a bizarre situation. Mick going to the National League draw in March and knowing that he's not coming out to the team in September is kind of strange, isn't it? Like the whole situation is kind of strange, really, with Stephen Kenny. And
I don't think there's anything particularly new in this. I mean, I think most people knew that this was what was going to happen. Obviously, McCarthy did an interview during the week, so I didn't think. But Philip Quinn had a great, there's a great lead into it. He says, divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. In Dublin this week, Miss McCarthy recalled the nursery rhyme about the fate of King Henry VIII's wives, six wives, as he predicted his, you know, the demise of international manners, and not just himself as well, obviously, because the Danish coach is gone as well, isn't he? He knows he's out the door as well, no matter what happens to him as well.
Yeah, plenty are, I suppose. Yep. It's just he's that unusual position where even if he did phenomenally well, which now, I mean, I think we've come to grips with the fact we may not win Euro 2020 and have that dilemma, but he was going regardless.
So, and the other interesting thing is he's not really making considering noises towards James McCarthy. He's like, McCarthy's playing regularly now for Crystal Palace, and you'd imagine that Mick would want him in his midfield for Slovakia, but he said he'll go and watch him play, but he has a set in midfield at the moment, so it doesn't look like he's going to put James McCarthy back in there, which might be a mistake, given the strength of Slovakia's midfield. But
Kenny Cunningham was saying during the week here in the show that he had watched McCarthy play recently and was very impressed to the point where he thought McCarthy really should come back into the squad.
Yeah.
But I know Mick said during the week as well that he'd called McCarthy up a few times and McCarthy hadn't shown up, so there was a slight cooling there, I think. But I'm sure pragmatism may reign if McCarthy, that's James McCarthy, keeps playing well.
Yeah, he hasn't played for Ireland since October 2017.
It's been a big hiatus in his career.
Yeah.
So let's turn to some of the bigger pieces then. Obviously, the Rory McIlroy, Paul Kimmage trilogy completes today, and it's across pages 2 and 3 of the Sunday Independent. The news line, if you're looking for a big news line, or what I suspect all the websites in the States will really pick on, the Golf Channel and everything, will be in relation to Brooks Koepka and that rivalry. Although don't call it a rivalry to Rory McIlroy, he doesn't want that to be how it's portrayed. But people will remember last year, 2019, that Koepka and McIlroy played in the final round of a big tournament in Memphis. And Brooks Koepka went out and was exceptionally good, and McIlroy really didn't play his golf at all. Subsequent to that, it would seem that there was a text message that McIlroy's manager, Sean O'Flaherty, had seen, and he mentioned it to McIlroy the week after the Memphis defeat. And Paul Kimmage says that to him, what Brooks was saying to his friends about you before that final round in Memphis. And McIlroy says, who told you about that? And Kimmage says, I'm going to crush him. This is what Koepka had said to his friends. I'm going to crush him. He repeats that 3 times to McIlroy. And McIlroy, in fairness, says, yeah, and F, he sort of did. And they both laugh about that. And that seems to have propelled McIlroy in Atlanta a little bit. He doesn't want to admit too much, I think, that he was angry. He doesn't want to give the sense that he plays golf angry, or you can play good golf angry.
Yeah.
But it was on his mind for sure, and he was maybe a bit less engaging with Koepka in the subsequent round they played after finding out about this text message. And he played really well that day. I mean, he was kind of tunnel vision that day. It was very memorable. It was a real, it felt like looking from afar, like a sea change in McIlroy's approach to these types of events where he is up against somebody like Brooks Koepka. That's kind of the big news line out today.
Yeah, exactly. But the interesting thing is, like, Paul Kimmich does, as he does and as works very well for him often is he answers a question to provoke a reaction. But in this case, McIlroy says, I took it as a compliment, and sort of tries to wave it off. So even though his performance afterwards might have been, as you said, you could see a difference in them. But in his point, he's saying is, I'm still not going to be nasty to people. That's not in my personality. And he actually talks about that at one point in here and says, you know, it's not, that's really, you know, he's saying life's not worth that really to get into. He says, I've never been a person who likes confrontation. It's never going to be me. It's not how I am. So, but you know, I mean, this is the third week of this. I'm inclined to be a bit like Bill Oddie died recently. It was one of the things that there used to be a comedy show in England where whenever the word cricket was mentioned, everybody would fall asleep. It's just there's been 3 weeks of it. I'm not sure how much more people who really aren't into golf would love this. And I'm not sure. I didn't certainly. That's the only thing I took out of this one today, except for there's two other lines. There's actually one interesting angle on the Olympics in it. So he says, you know, why are you playing in the Olympics, basically, he's been asked. You know, you said you wouldn't play. Now you've turned around and you said you will play. And McIlroy is very, very firm in things of saying, I'm not there about the flags. I don't want to be, I'm not into this kind of, you know, and he's reiterated that line about how I'm sort of, you know, I live in America, I was born in Northern Ireland, you know, blah, 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 blah. I feel I'm a kind of a citizen of the world. And Kimmich makes a very good point, but it's the Olympic Games. It's all about flags. It's almost only about the flags. And he says, I know, but I'm still going. And he says he's going because he feels it is a unique sporting thing. And he says, I should have a right to do it. Now, I often wonder, is it to do with sponsors more than anything else? You know, I think that is the unasked question that he's never really been asked. Why didn't you go to Rio, you know, and why are you going to Japan? And he's saying, I'm going to Japan because it's a place where golf is huge, you know. But I would often wonder and say, I wonder, is it because his sponsors might be huge over there as well? But that's just me being a bit cynical, yeah.
No, I would have thought that as well. Japan's a huge market for Nike, but...
The other line I thought was interesting in it is actually towards the end where he does, you know, talk about the majors and everything. And McIlroy says, Kimmich says, it's been an interesting ride. And McIlroy says it has. But I think most careers have those ups and downs. We've been talking about Tiger, but how about this? Tiger didn't win a Masters in his 30s, which I think is a really interesting line to make. He won one when he was 29 and one when he was 43. And I think it's interesting that he brings that up in it.
Yeah. Golf is definitely full of those ups and downs, although Tiger was going through some fairly unique circumstances at the time, I suppose. The point still holds, though. I mean, golf is very difficult in that sense when you have to peak for just four times a year. Like, what jumped out at me was he does acknowledge to a point post Port Rush that he did need to reset a little bit, actually. And he'd sort of rejected that because there was a clip of even this pay-per-view played to him the previous week where he rejected some of the things in it. But he talks about what he was saying to himself post-Port Rush, where he said, I got to keep reading, keep juggling, blah, 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 better diet, got lazy, not disciplined. And Kimmich says to him, bring more intensity. Isn't that what some of your critics were talking about? The lack of anger and the lack of fight seems worrying. And Roy says, yeah, but there's a difference between intensity and anger. Now, the anger point was more actually about post-round in Port Rush. I think Andy Dunn, it was saying he wanted to see a bit more anger from him in that particular instance. But I don't think anybody thinks you can play good golf angry across 4 days for 6 hours each day. But intensity, it was a really good word McIlroy used, because if I was to characterise what we've seen from McIlroy post-Port Rush, there has been an intensity about him, single-minded focus, still a calmness about him, a ruthlessness about him, and we're even seeing it at a Riviera, whether he wins or not this evening. All the signs are really good that he is disciplined again. And he, you know, he says he's not irked by Koepka sending that text message. He is and he isn't. Like, Brooks Koepka texted all his friends saying, I'm going to crush him.
Yeah, yeah.
And then went out the next day and duly crushed him.
Yeah.
Now, you don't have to be confrontational for that to trigger something in you. And I do think that we are seeing somebody who is really focused and in a really good place. The signs are really good for 2020.
But the only measure that, Joe, is going to be the majors. I mean, that's the only thing that Rory's measuring himself against. So,
which is incredibly harsh.
I know, but... standard he's set, and he's the number one golfer in the world, so... I think the only evidence to change is going to be when we see him in Augusta or later on in the year.
Maybe. Yeah, and Kimmich makes that point as well, doesn't he, in this as well, is that that's going to be the real measure of it. But he does come back to that argument about, you know, he's never going to be mouthy. He's never going to be the one sending the nasty. Like, it's not his personality, if you like. But there is a line where he says, you know, he doesn't care. You know, people might take that as being, I'm too submissive, but he's saying, you know, I care more than people know, you know. And there is that weird thing with McIlroy where you think he cares too much sometimes, and then at other times he looks like he doesn't care at all, you know. I just thought that the post-Port Rush stuff was very vague. I was surprised. I thought there was going to be some big revelation this week about what he did when he came home from Port Rush, and I didn't think that it was here necessarily. I know he got out his notebook and everything, you know. Look, you know, this is a... You know, this is a big exclusive in that, you know, this is one of the global superstars in sport at the moment, and Paul Kimmich has such a great relationship. He can sit down and talk to him. So 3 weeks of this will be lapped up by some people, you know, and internationally as well. There'll be huge interest in this. But I suppose just for me, I think at this stage, I was hoping that there might be something really, really new in it, and I didn't find it in it. But I know people who love golf, and I'm not a golf fanatic, will be really interested in probably every word of it. You know, it's just a different thing.
There was an ad in Sky Sports this morning when I was watching Sunday Supplement that said Rory's big revelation on Sunday Independent, but I didn't see it here today. I don't... Was it the Brooks thing?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. They presume it's the Brooks Koepka he's talking about. But like, there's even the last section of it is, you know, it's broken into sections, and the last section is the females in his life, and then at the very last paragraph it mentions his wife, but there's nothing else. It's sort of just kind of left there. You know, he says to him, what's the most important? What would the golfer of the decade pick as the moment of the decade? And he says, getting married. Mm. And then there's just a brief mention to that and his mum being at the Open. She's only actually been there for the only one major win. But that's all it is. So I just thought, I thought there might have been something bigger in it, you know. But I think if you're a golf person, maybe you will take more from, you know, like last week's. You know, I didn't take much from the fact that he read a lot of self-help books, but maybe some other people would. It's, you know, it is a game between the years still, so I suppose all that stuff is interesting.
Mm. Yeah, well, it will be big news in the golfing world, the Brooks Koepka line.
Yeah.
Guaranteed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Brooks will be asked about it, and it will all be stirred up. And even though McIlroy very understandably doesn't want to create a quote-unquote rivalry, I suspect he sees it as wasted energy. And he said it on a few different occasions across the three interviews, that golf is not a game where thinking about the other person does you all that much service. You're better off focusing on yourself. So he does not want to create this Brooks v. Rory narrative.
Rivalry thing,
but
yeah.
This will now be huge in the world of golf.
Yeah.
At the next press conference, they both will sit down. Brooks, you texted all your friends saying you're going to crush Rory. How are things with Rory? And Brooks Koepka will say some more things. And then Rory, not that he'll want to be asked about it, will be asked about Brooks Koepka. And on we go. I can't. Augusta cannot come here soon enough. is all I'll say. So it's all set up, and he's at Riviera this evening. Rory playing really, really well.
Yeah, he is playing well.
So let's move on to Brendan Doyle, page 62 of the Mail on Sunday. And Mark, you did this interview with Brendan Doyle. I have to say, it's quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
Who is Brendan Doyle? Start there for people.
Okay. Well, I met Brendan during the week and went out to Swords to meet him in a coffee shop, and he's a skeleton racer who 2 weeks ago got a solidarity grant from the Olympic Federation of Ireland, which helps winter sports and minority sports, athletes in winter sports, fund their season. Because, as he's pointing out to me, and as Neil Reardon did a piece from the Sun as well, like, it's a pretty expensive sport, skeleton. Like he said, just to go down once on a track costs €60 or something. Like, that's just training. Like, so it's really expensive. So the solidarity grant, I think, helped him out big time. But, like, his backstory is incredible. Like, he's... I had a bit of an idea, because I did a bit of research on him beforehand, that he went through in pretty traumatic time. He was a guard based out in Crumlin, and he was called it a domestic disturbance. Mm-hmm. And in the process of arresting the suspect, he got stabbed. His little finger in his right hand doesn't work anymore, and he's lost nerves in his thumbs. But because of the incident, he got post-traumatic stress syndrome, suffers from insomnia. He basically said he's, for about 5 years, he's only sleeping an hour a night. He was driving around, driving the car, driving the Galway and back, just to fill his hours during the night.
If you don't mind, Mark, I might just read his quotes about that, because even that's grabs you. That's kind of in the first column where he talks about going to the domestic abuse incident. He said the Gardaí face those every single day. They can be volatile because they're so personal and you're an outsider. And, you know, his thumb was cut and or his little finger, and that's a serious enough thing. But, you know, it's really the post-traumatic stress which is the issue. So he says, it began with the night terrors. I had dreams that would wake me up thinking the suspect was standing over me with a knife. That line hit me. Like, imagine waking up routinely and there's someone standing over you with a knife. Or I'd wake, grabbing my hand, thinking it was still bleeding. It was impossible to get back to sleep. If you knew that every time you went to bed, that you would be woken up by this traumatically, eventually you're going to stop going to bed.
That's what grabbed me when he said I was going to go.
Well, I mean, how could you face your bed if that's what awaited you? So
it's where it's our sanctuary for most of it at the end of a tough day.
Yes. So he, as you said, he would spend the nights, and please resume and the story, but he said he would spend the nights circling the city on the M50. Yeah. And then he said, I would start then driving to Cork and back home to Dublin. Then I'd drive to Galway another night and back home. Then I'd come home and maybe have an hour's sleep for 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, 5 years, he said. Pretty much he was surviving in 1 or 2 hours sleep a night. And eventually got to the stage where he saw no other way out than to attempt suicide. And I didn't know he'd gone to that darker place before I met him, so...
So in the conversation, you didn't know things had got that bad for
him? Yeah, I didn't know it had got that bad. Mm. And what was interesting, because he had a sporting background, he was a sprinter in his teens, and he said that his sporting background, being an athlete, you're taught to push through setbacks, but you can't do that with mental health, I mean, because you just hit a brick wall, he was saying, so...
Yeah, that was actually a very profound comment, full of wisdom on his part, because he did say, yeah, mental health is different to sport. It doesn't respond if you keep pushing back.
Yeah.
You know, he couldn't find a way out of it. And he talked about how suffering with insomnia 5 years, when you're not sleeping, you lose the ability to start afresh. My social circle fell apart. I'd no energy. I'd no interest in going out. I went out with my girlfriend for 3.5 years. That ended. I stopped going to the gym. Anyone who knows me will tell you I love the gym and I love my training. And he said he tried counselling, he tried medication, and ultimately reached a point where he was going to attend something so dreadful and so serious. And I'm just conscious as well, the weekend that's in it, and dreadful news surrounding Caroline Flack's passing, just horrendous last night. Anyone listening in any difficulty, the Samaritans have a free phone number. It's 116 123, 116 123. Reach out and talk. Because this guy, who is now hopefully going to go to the Winter Olympics and saw no way out, has now found an incredible way out, and his life has flourished. And really, and I don't want to go into the details because that's not deemed to be responsible reporting on the airways. It's detailed here in a very good and proper way by Mark. But really, he was kind of sparked out of doing something he was going to do by a child and a mother nearby, and that almost made him think, okay, what am I doing here? And he called a friend, got back into the car, broke down in tears, and called a friend.
And they went to Tesco's, and he told his friend in Tesco's, just, and that was the start of it. That gave him stepping stones to get back to where he is, to hopefully represent Ireland in the Olympics.
What's it like having a conversation with Brendan in a Starbucks in Swords, and he's pouring this out to you? Sometimes in Starbucks, you're sitting very close to the table next to you.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting it, to be honest. And like, but he's a very articulate guy, and he's obviously thought a lot about where he's come from and where he is now. And the funny thing is, I mean, he only missed out from going to the last Winter Olympics by a point.
He just missed out. Yeah. He was terribly unlucky. Yeah.
One point, like as close as he gets, and he was thinking that it's not going to happen for me. He's actually going to quit the sport, and then he said. He came home, he watched the skeleton on TV during the Olympics, and he rediscovered his drive to get back.
He had done it once before, he was telling Mark. So he'd done it once before. He was in school, and he'd gone to the skeleton place in the Alps. And it's a great line. He says, some guy, the first time in the sled, I was put on top of the run. Some guy pushed me off saying, goodbye, Ireland. And I think it's a great line. Mark has been very modest here. Two people have this have an interview with him today. So Neela Reardon has an interview with him in The Sun as well, which is very good. But it's really interesting to see how different they are. And I think that's the gift of writers sometimes is the angle that you take and how you explore it. So Neil's angle is a really interesting one. It's all about the weight of his equipment, how difficult it is to get around the world, what it costs him. You know, there's this image of him. He puts all his clothes on. He puts as much clothes on as possible when he's checking in so that his baggage is as light as possible. And then he carries all his gear. And like you have really good details on it as well. The cost of his gear, the weight of his gear, all of that stuff. So he goes on that angle. But Mark chose, obviously in the course of the conversation and being the person that you are, and you do get really good interviews from people involved in lesser known sports, that you actually were brave enough to take, you know, to go with it when he started to talk about this. So your angle is very different. And you have everything in it as well. But it's a really, really, really great interview. Just every aspect of it is brilliant because you have all the details about how he does the sport and what the sport costs. And you have to be so brave to do this thing. Like they're going down. If you've ever been, I've been on the side of a track. So at Winter Olympics, I've seen the speed these guys go past it. It's over 100 miles an hour.
Well, we've all seen Cool Runnings, Cliona. We understand. I mean, really.
But it's the noise. The noise when they go past you is absolutely terrifying. Because it's just like they're very basic. These things, like they're wooden. The bases of the tracks are wooden. You can hear it shaking when they go past you, and the noises, and they whoosh past you, and you think, how on earth is a human being holding on to that thing and going down there? So, like that aspect of it is fascinating alone. But this, the exploration of his mental health that you've done in it is really interesting. And to me as well, I think what's really interesting, Mark, is that he just missed out on Pyeongchang, and he's trying to qualify for the next Winter Olympics. But I think as well that the support systems that are in place for him, he trains now, he does all his S&C and stuff out at the Institute of Sport. So there are other athletes around him now, and probably people that he can talk to, whereas I think a lot of athletes, Irish athletes who are off around the world in minority sports, they don't have that fellowship, if you like, but they have it now. And I thought it was really interesting with Taekwondo, with Jack Woolley recently, which I think was that your brilliant piece with Jack Woolley recently. Him talking about, even when I'm out in the Institute, I kind of feel different because nobody knows anything about my sport. But I've noticed with Brendan Doyle, he's very active on social media, and he does seem to be very involved. And obviously that has been a great help to him as well in recovering his mental health.
But
he was
saying about the circuit as well. I mean, every other country has high performance teams, like the British have a team. And, like, he drives around Europe on his own 23 hours on his own in the car.
And sleeps in it
in it just to save money. And everyone he's competing against, like, have their own team of coaches and S&C guys. And
you have to be incredibly focused to do it. You know, very brave, very focused. But to have survived everything he did, you know, and been a guard and all that sort of thing, you have it all here. Like, it's a really brilliant read.
I mean, there's loads of stories like these in smaller sports in Ireland. It's just
to find them.
Find them. And during the summer, then when the championship starts, obviously GA just engulfs everything. So
yeah, well, we'll move on to GA in a moment. Look, it's great. We wish him well. So he's looking to get to the Winter Olympics in 2022. He has to make it into the top 60, I think, in the world in Beijing. Yeah. That's upcoming. And then hopefully get to the Olympics then. As I understand it, actually, he's going to be on Off the Ball next Saturday. Neil just let me know. So he's booked to come in. So that would be a chat worth catching. This is definitely an interview worth reading. Like, again, on the back of the dreadful news last night, it's a story of hope. Someone who's found complete purpose again after sinking to the deepest of depths, so we wish him well. That's on page 62 of the Mail.
If you follow him on social media, he trains hard.
I'm sure.
You know, he trains really hard as well. People, I think people have that impression that you just throw yourself on a tray and these things and you go down. You know what I mean? You just have to be brave, but you actually have to be incredibly fit and strong as well.
Yeah, I've no doubt. So that is Brendan Doyle. Next to GAA, you mentioned, and that will take over come the summertime. GAA versus GPA, much talk of money, much talk of the direction of the GAA. Shane McGrath's writing a piece, Joe Brawley, Colm O'Rourke, John Green, Mick Foley is talking about it as well, Dennis Walsh on Porky Queeve and beyond. This was obviously a big story during the week. It's the kind of story that the Sunday papers tend to have a bit of time to reflect on. So where do we want to start, or what's the overall consensus across the papers?
Well,
it's hard to find a consensus, isn't it?
The GPA statement. I was telling Cliona earlier when we were going through the papers, when I arrived in my inbox on Wednesday, because I did the Tom Ryan's report for our paper, I thought I'd missed something in Tom Ryan's report. because it just didn't make any sense to me.
So the context for people is Tom Ryan, the Director General, his first report, and one of the points he made, and I think people welcomed it, was that he effectively looked at the 11% increase in the spend to prepare senior inter-county teams in particular.
Yeah.
That had gone up by 11%.
Yeah, almost 30
million. Up to 30 million. Yeah. That's a huge figure.
It's a lot of money. And so I think effectively he used the word unsustainable.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like he was lashing out, I think, at inter-county players in any great way. But as you said, that you then followed the GPA's statement.
Yeah. Where they used the term problem child, which, as Shane points out in his column, has other connotations in an Irish sporting context, obviously. With the League of Ireland, and someone described him as a difficult child. I didn't realise it was actually a difficult child, he said. But
it was a strange thing for the GPA to go with problem child, given it's such an infamous term in Irish sport, and it was used as a stick to beat John Delaney with for a long time. Like, were they trying to pivot into being the victims here? Did they think that just by saying that, even when Tom Ryan hadn't used that phrase, that it would be used against the GAA, that they were talking about the inter-county players as the problem child? That was not what Tom Ryan had said.
No, it wasn't at all. Tom Ryan's reporting, Paul Rouse is in here, obviously, chair during the week, and Paul isn't afraid of taking GAA to task at times, but he said it was a very measured report. Mm. Now, that's what I thought reading it. I mean, there's 60 pages, and it was very measured and very kind of sober.
There was nowhere in it, Mark, where he singled out the GPA or the players, for causing all these problems. I'm exactly the same as you. I thought that's a very strange one. And so people are reacting to it in the paper today. As Joe Brawley's reacting to it, Colm O'Rourke is reacting to it, Shane McGrath and also McClifford in the Mail on Sunday. And they're right, because I agree. I'm with them on this, I don't agree a lot with Colm O'Rourke on things, but I do agree with him in this case. It's like they took offence at something that actually nobody was giving offence to. Tom Ryan was saying the costs associated with inter-county are spiralling, and we've got to get a hold on them. The GPA then came out and said, we're the people who are creating all of this, and we're your most important asset, and you can't be basically saying, without saying it, you shouldn't be criticising us. But he wasn't criticising them, and I think that's the mistake. But this point about the GPA we're making, that we're the revenue generating machine that allows the GAA to compete with rugby and soccer and other sports. First of all, nobody was saying that this was their fault. The fault is with managers, I think. The fault is with people building up these huge backroom teams that are costing so much money, and also maybe in how they're spending the money.
And as Tom Ryan acknowledged, the length of the season.
The length of the season, the fixtures.
His hands up,
this is exactly, he did make that point. But what I thought was really missing in the GPA statement was, not only did they seem to be taking offence at something that wasn't criticising them, but also they were also leaving out, which doesn't help their case, they were leaving out the other vital thing, which is the volunteers in the GAA. And so the GAA's wealth isn't just built on the inter-county player. It's built on the back of all those people in all those clubs who help and coach and get kids to a point where they can become great. And I think that's a mistake to leave them out of the thing.
Because Shane McGrath writes in the Mail, and yet Paul Flynn has managed to take great umbrage at this. The GPA has decided to take a matter that is affecting every tier of the GAA and make it about themselves. He later quotes a statement from the GPA where the GPA say, "Our inter-county games are the flagship promotional and developmental tool that keeps the GAA in the news, and journalists, pundits, administrators, coaches, physios and all the other professionals within the inter-county games in jobs."
Yeah.
And again, that just seemed inflammatory.
Yeah, and it's leaving out the volunteers as well, Joe, which I think is insulting, because they're the people where it starts at. So if you don't have them in the family, I think as well, you're missing a point there. You're missing this point completely. And also, it's volunteers at the moment who are making, two groups like the CPA, who've been making the biggest argument with the GAA about sorting out the fixtures and taking the pressure off players and clubs and all the rest. So I just, they seem to pick a fight, I thought, when there was no fight to be picked.
I think I agree with what you said, Mark, is where Tom Ryan's report followed by the GPA statement, I suddenly thought, we've missed something.
Yeah, I thought I missed the story.
Report here. This did not seem like an attack on the players.
A couple of people are saying, Joe, that maybe they reacted this way because they're currently negotiating a new deal, a new player agreement. It's wrong to call it a deal, I suppose, but a new agreement with them on the way forward. So in a few pieces today, they're arguing that. But even if that was the case, you know, it's like they're trying to put a stance to say you're not going to push us around in this. But again, I don't think, you know, they're not the ones really that Ryan, I think, has the argument with. The problem is, of course, is that the people that are driving the spend are uncontrolled by anybody and are answerable to nobody, really, which is the whole county management and the size of their professional things and how much money they are spending on teams, you know. Yeah. And you can't put a salary cap in, or, you know, you can't even put... A few people are talking about this in articles today. I mean, McClifford is good. As I said, some of the stuff in Sunday Indo is very good. John Green has a good piece. One of the problems is that even if you put a spending cap... How can you make that fair? Because you have counties that are so different from each other. Mm. You know, if, for example, Dublin probably don't spend as much at all on player transport. The richest, you know, county in the place, because most of their players are based virtually in Dublin. So they don't have to do things like organise buses to bring people to training or have a training halfway, midway between their Dublin-based players. They don't have those things. So it's virtually impossible to control that spending thing. But the GAA are now saying, we've got to try and do something because too much money has been spent on this area.
Just on John Green's piece, because actually it made for good reading in many ways. Yeah. Like I thought the situation was going to be far more dire. So the headline is success coming at too heavy a price. And John makes the point, one that we all know, I think, if you drive through a lot of towns, most clubs now have their own facilities, the pitch, dressing room, floodlights, walking tracks. Most county towns also boast a GAA stadium of some kind too. Soccer lags a long, long way behind, which is all true. He said, aside from Cork, among the counties feeling the pressure of paying off debt include Mayo, 9.4 million, neighbours Galway, they're around 3 million. But he says that generally our charts show most county boards are in a relatively strong financial position. They're well resourced to deal with any debt they have incurred. Combined current assets exceed 46 million, fixed assets exceed 286 million. So he says, like Kilkenny, minimal debt, they have a cash balance of nearly a million, Kerry of over a million. He said Kildare, who overcame a financial crisis, they have 724 grand, Cavan 600 grand, and on it goes. So actually, you know, the general picture is not one of disaster. I thought we'd see more county boards really struggling, really in the red. So it's not the doomsday scenario that we might kind of think. We are going to take a very short break here on the wireless. We're on all our social platforms as well. Short ad break. We're going to continue here on Twitter and Facebook Live and Instagram or wherever you're watching us, YouTube as well. After the break on the radio, Nathan is going to pick things up from Villa Park if you want commentary of that game. Myself and Mark and Kleena will continue here with the paper review. And continue we will. So the point, the ad break really ruined the momentum of my point there. But like things are both, it seems, quite well run. And financially, this looks very good. And yet there's an awful lot of... we really need to address everything that's going wrong in the GAA. So try and make sense of that for me, Mark. I understand, OK, look, the clubs the fixtures and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But this is not the Armageddon, to use that Man City headline, situation that people might have feared. When you heard about the spend on senior county teams, you would have thought, God, this is it is unsustainable, is Tom Ryan's point. But... at the same time, seems to have been pretty sustainable up till now.
Well, yeah, but I suppose, but the one thing I'd question there, Joe, is it is sustainable, right? But should all that be the bigger question, I think, for a lot of people in the GA is, should all that money be being spent on the inter-county teams?
Point, yeah.
And if it's not being spent there, should it not be spent at more local level and development and coaching and all those other things that we think
that's
are important?
That's fair enough. Yeah,
But you agree, like actually what the Sunday Independent do show is that actually a lot of places are breaking even. One third of that big debt that they talked about at the start is Cork. Mm-hmm. And that the problem with Cork, that overdevelopment of what was it, Colm O'Rourke described it as a vanity project. Which is, you know, is a fairly good description of it. And in the Sunday Times, Dennis Walsh and Michael Foley look at that Cork situation, the Parker Creeve situation, because that is different than what we're talking about in the other area.
Mm. Colm O'Rourke does say of Porky Creeve, this is not a victimless crime. Every club looking for a grant suffers, so will a lot of other grounds in need of urgent repair and renewal. So I guess that is the obvious knock-on effect.
Like John makes the point that
John Green
that the structure of county boards has to change given so much money.
Yeah.
He's sloshing around there like And he's talking about having an executive board, wasn't he, with a financial controller and chief operating officer? Which is, which makes sense, really, doesn't it? I mean, that's probably...
Well, when you've that much money. Yeah. Although there was, I think it might have been John a couple of weeks ago, certainly, he interviewed a county board member who had said, yeah, really, like, we're medium-sized business now. There's millions coming through here, and we need an executive in place. He said maybe one of the reasons that was less likely to happen is because suddenly all the amateur players are saying, geez, everybody is getting paid here except us. And, you know, the county board structure is the same as it was 20, 30 years ago, but the funds coming through would have increased dramatically. And county boards need to react to that. But it, maybe it's just another layer of people getting paid reasonably well and the players aren't. Now, that's not quite a good enough reason not to do with it, to do it when you don't have those sums. But
that, it is a lot of money. You see, I think it is that it's just when people hear the size of money, everyone goes, oh my God, as you say, oh Armageddon, oh my goodness, what's going on? But actually, sometimes when you drill down into it and look at it, what's interesting, I think, is that the Indo show that people are coping with this spend, but the bigger question probably is where should the spend be going? Yeah. And they're raising that. And also they're raising the issue of, are the people dealing with all this money qualified to be dealing with it? And should there not be a level of sort of paid executives dealing with all that or bring other people on? There's a motion going to Congress, I think, that you should have, one county's put in a motion about having two professional money people on the thing to control it. And now, as we've seen with the FAI, that doesn't always necessarily work out either. But like, there's some strong views on it. I think people are worth reading them. Smell of money leaving a stench is the one on Brawley's one. Yeah, I wouldn't go as far as agreeing with him at all.
He accuses the GPA of having a touch rate worldview, pretty much. And
yeah, which I wouldn't go that far. I think there's a really interesting piece as well that is worth a read in the Mail on Sunday by Shane McGrath, and it's with Tommy Kinnoy. The headline on it is, and we'll say who he is in a minute, but GAA has become so centralised, it's corporate elitism now. And that's a quote from Tommy Kinnoy. And if anybody knows Tommy Kinnoy or has ever heard the name, Tommy is your classic, you know, county board volunteer who has done extraordinary things in some way. He's from Roscommon, and he was the guy who got rid of Rule 42, that awful rule that didn't allow people from the Defence Forces in Northern Ireland to play in the GAA. Tommy is one of those guys who's worked away at the ground for a long time and affected huge change in the GAA. You know what I mean? You know, people always give out about suits, you know what I mean? Or, you know, they kind of draw local administrators as, you know, these idiots. Tommy Kinnoy is your classic man who's done incredible work. And so when you see somebody like Tommy saying, you know, the figures are too big and we're still not sorting out this fixture issue, that's where there is definitely, you know, we can identify that it's not just about money as well, it's about a lot more. And by the way, this is a fascinating, I mean, really good piece. Sometimes, you know, I read a great piece by PM O'Sullivan in the Examiner after Christmas, and it was about a man called Jimmy Dunn. And Jimmy Dunn used to be, Mark probably know him, Jimmy used to be on the disciplinary side in Croke Park. He's a shopkeeper in Arklow, and it was a brilliant piece, and he had this brilliant line about it, saying that Jimmy Dunn was a suit who never became a grey man, which I thought was a fantastic description of people who we don't appreciate sometimes in administration. And this piece on Tommy Kinnoy is a great piece as well, isn't it? Yeah. Because he was born in New York. It talks about him. Actually, he was drafted. Vietnam. I never knew that. It's a fascinating piece and a really good read as well. And it just shows sometimes, like, the papers are full of stories about money today between Man City and there's a good one about rugby and money in the Business Post. But sometimes as well, you know, it's about people, great people and interesting people. And this is a brilliant piece. It's a really good interview, I think.
Well, I thought, interesting thing with Tommy Kinnoy, like, he's been pretty much on the right side of history for everything GAA have changed in the last 30 or 40 years that need to be changed. And he's quite active now in the CPA, so that'll tell you.
I think that's almost the hook for it.
Yeah, the club players.
This guy, as you said, has been right about so many things, has now decided that the CPA is where he should funnel his efforts. So he's pushing for that situation to be changed. He calls the CPA a cry for help.
Yeah.
And he says, this talk about the GAA being truly democratic, that's not the case. He says, going to Congress, how much of the stuff is brought to county boards to mandate delegates to go to Congress? He says, a lot of it isn't. He says, presidential elections, how many times are counties asked to mandate their delegates? Rarely does it happen. And he goes on to say, what's happening now is worrying. It's become so centralised. He does say it's about corporate elitism. Big matches, big gates, big games, the Super 8s. He says, for the first time ever, I think you're hearing complaints from places like Kilkenny about club fixtures and mentions Brian Cody. So that's where he's, and as you said, been a shrewd operator for a long time. He's now seen that as the big crisis in GAA at the moment.
Yeah, and he makes a point, a really interesting point as well, and it's been made before by the CPA, that for forever it was an honour for somebody in your club to play for the county. Like, it was such a huge honour for your club, and it was so prestigious, and that's what you strive for in your club. And he's saying that he feels that now they've got to a point where actually it's not an honour, because now they're not even worried. You'll hear club people saying, we're lucky we've no one on the county panel, so that they can have a full team out and they can play their games and be successful at local level. There's a lot in it. It's a really interesting piece, and there's a fantastic finish. I love a punchline at the end of an article, and he says, Tommy Kanoy has served the GAA as a player and administrator most of his life. His greatest service has come through questioning, though. He continues the search for answers, you know, and that point is that, you know, we'll see. Congress will come up in a couple of weeks' time. Mm-hmm. Everyone will be having a good laugh and saying, "Oh, look at them, you know, men in grey suits, all in there." But actually, you know, there are people in there trying to make a real difference and trying to fight hard to have change. Still, even though they may look like conservative people, they aren't necessarily.
Yeah. Shane McGrath there, page 70 of the Mail on Sunday. You mentioned the money then. Man City are everywhere. You talked, I think Rob Draper gave it about one of the better efforts to try and make sense of it all.
Yeah, I mean, some of the coverage of it I was disappointed in, because, like, I thought the Sundays would really take this on and be strong in it. And actually, I think Rob Draper's piece in the Mail is one of the better pieces on it. So, look, people will it's complicated stuff, okay? But basically, their angle on it is, I mean, my attitude the minute this story broke was, the only people who are going to be happy about this is lots of lawyers making lots of money, and they are going to make big money on this, because you can guarantee that the people who own Man United or Man City are going to employ the most expensive lawyers in the world. They have to go to CAS, so they're going to appeal this to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. But there's a very interesting piece here, because he's saying basically that Galatasaray went to CAS with this before and actually got slapped down on it. And the reason they got slapped down on it was, like, they wanted the financial fair play thing to be declared illegal under Swiss and European law, but CAS ruled that no violation of EU competition law has been established, and also they kind of, in that judgment, they kind of said that Galatasaray didn't challenge this before, only when it got sanctioned under the rule. In other words, you know, you didn't make a point when this came in originally. So, look, this is going to run, obviously.
Rob makes the point here, and it's actually laying out bare. Like, if City don't win their case in CAS, like, the whole Abu Dhabi project will have to be completely overhauled. And if they do win, then the foundations of financial fair play will be undermined, so the stakes couldn't be higher. I mean, if you're a City fan, say it's brilliant times. I've been feeling all year that Pep might walk away at the end of the season. He certainly will walk away now if this ban's upheld. But I suppose Castle will have to make a ruling on it pretty swiftly, won't they? Had an extra Champions League.
Well, that's it, yeah. They'd have to make a decision so that they could figure out what's happening for next year in Europe,
July 23rd is what Rob Draper says. But, you know, he has a box, because it's a complex enough case. Certain points are straightforward. So, for instance, he points out that Der Spiegel last year, they indicated that, as an example of what may have happened here, in 2015, Etihad was paying just £8 million towards a then £67 million deal. So Etihad had a sponsorship deal, and still do, obviously, with Man City. £67 million in 2015. But Etihad was actually only paying £8 million, it seems, while Sheikh Mansour was topping up the remaining £59 million. If that's confirmed as accurate, that is a breach of financial fair play. So that is an example of what they're being accused of here, if you're wondering. Some inflated sponsorship deals, and Der Spiegel alleging that Sheikh Mansour personally or somebody very close to him is making up the balance.
Was making up a big making up not making up the balance, Joe, paying most of it.
Yeah, okay. Making up 59 million of 67.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, I suppose the other thing is, if, like, will Sheikh Mansour stick around? Like, he's put 1.5 billion into the City project as it is. Will he stick around if...
Oh, the whole thing could crumble very quickly.
It could easily just all blow up. Like.
But the interesting thing about that is, though, like somebody has a great line, I've forgotten where I saw it today, but it's that great line, like, rich people don't believe that, you know, rich people believe they can write their own rules, yeah. You know? Like, this is a vanity project as well, you know, for the people who own the club. You know, this is prestige. This is about owning, you know, this incredibly successful club, and it's part of your, you know, of your wealth and I suppose your status in the world. So, you know, the presumption that they will walk away easily, I think, is wrong.
Yeah, billionaires
I think
don't.
Billionaires don't walk away. Yeah, there are other things tied in with
this. Have you watched Succession at all?
I have, yeah.
Well, we won't give away any spoilers, but there is that moment where Logan Roy, played by Brian Cox, at the end of a long negotiation, just turns around and says, money always wins.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
That is the attitude. Yeah.
That's why I find the papers today so depressing, because it is all about money. That's why that piece...
Welcome to the real world, Cleaner.
On the skeleton. I know. Because for me, sport is about people, but like it's just the pages today are dominated about buying money. And then, like I never understand why... there isn't a salary cap in English football. It's always baffled me. Salary caps are the only way to control where the money goes or where the salary caps and draft system. There's an awful lot wrong with American sport, and also, obviously, people find ways around loopholes around everything, right, including American sport. But even if that does, if it in some way tries to balance things out in terms of where the money goes and where the talent goes, surely that's the only solution, because the amount of money washing around international football at the moment is just, like, it's obscene, in my opinion. Yeah. I've said that before. And also, like, yesterday, you know, so you're watching Norwich-Liverpool, 55 points between them before they started playing. Do you know what I mean? And we're not even... And then you would look at the money between them. Mm. And there was a great piece done by... it was Miguel Delaney during the week in The Independent. Mm. And just this notion about just the haves and the have-nots in football and how the gap is just getting, you know, it's untenable.
Miguel, in that piece, it's well worth a read. It's on the Independent website, I'm sure, still, or you'll get it on Twitter. One of the Premier League's top six, an executive in a hotel room with the other top sixes, said, well, look, we don't want too many Leicester situations.
Yeah, God forbid.
It's bad for the game. Because the big clubs attract the most money, and it just may, you know, that's what people want to support, the big clubs who win big things. The notion that you're from Norwich and you support Norwich is a quaint, outdated one.
And yet, you know what, Joe? I would argue that Leicester's run and Leicester's victory brought people back to football that may have left it.
Yeah, that's a fair point. That's probably true, yeah.
You know, I would argue it might bring people, it brought people, it made me interested in English soccer again. Yeah. You know, and I don't think I'm the only one. And I think that's what's lost. You know, you have, you know, there's just such a gap between the money, these people with so much money and what they think is influencing the sport and those of us who, you know, just love sport for the humanity in it, if you like.
Mm. There was Ajax's run in the Champions League last year.
Yeah.
I know Ajax are obviously a very prestigious club, but they didn't have the money that... top clubs in Europe. No.
And Miguel's point was, he wasn't talking about English football. He looked at all of the leagues in Europe where top the places, huge gaps have occurred and where it's only going one way.
Yeah, that's the point, actually. He listed out in the last decade, you're having more trebles, more dominance, a first Champions League hat-trick in however many years. And more interestingly, even, I don't know, was it 3 or 4 nils, but a certain score line, you're having a far, far higher percentage of games where it's hammerings are being dished out, basically.
It was a brilliant piece of work. The amount of, I mean, it's obviously a piece that he's been working on for a long time, but just the depth of analysis in it was something that I'd expect to see, you know, as I said, I would have expected to see more of.
Gary Lineker called it a thesis. He was one of those retweeting it.
Just coming back to City, I mean, City fans already had a skewed view of our UEFA. They've been booing the Champions League team music already, so I'd say the atmosphere is going to be fun now in the Real game in a few weeks' time.
I'm sure it will. The City response, by the way, and it's in Rob Draper's piece, is simply put, they say this is a case initiated by UEFA, prosecuted by UEFA and judged by UEFA. So they say it's a prejudicial process, it's now over. They're going to go to somebody impartial. That is their argument. That's a very much, you can see
that's a legal standpoint. It's like when it came out, they were saying, oh, there's been a leak, not you know, they didn't even try and defend it. They weren't saying, we haven't done anything wrong. They were saying, oh, how's this got out, kind of, you know, it was that classic thing of deflecting the blame, deflecting the story. And of course, you'd imagine looking at it from the outside, but again, lawyers are very clever. You know, it's not the first time City have got smacked on the wrist as well. Yeah. So, like, I'd find it hard to know how they're going to argue it when they've already been pulled up and fined before, but... You know, it's been
extraordinary. And as we mentioned at the top, De Bruyne, they wanted to sign a 450 grand a week contract. Sterling, 450 grand. De Bruyne and Laporte, 300 grand contracts. So straight away, they may all be in some kind of jeopardy for obvious reasons. Before we go, we had a few other things jotted down. I know you had Barry White in the Business Post. You had umpires with Dermot Crowe. Dermot Cleese talked to Ronan Collins, who Ronan Collins thought he was going to make it on the senior European tour playing off a 6 handicap. That's my favourite story of the whole weekend.
I was really impressed the fact that he was playing off a 6 handicap.
It was very good, but I mean that he was doing the maths and he was like, I'm about, you know, whatever, 10 years away from the seniors here. I could really make a mark up there, and it didn't happen.
It's a nice piece.
He's out to 16 now.
Yeah, it is a lovely piece.
Obviously, pretty nice broadcaster as well, so he's more than happy in life, but he thought he was going to make the seniors tour. Like so many of us when we're playing good golf, we think, I wonder. So there's that, but Barry White's talking about CVC and their invasion into rugby, really. They've taken Premiership, a stake there. They've taken a big stake in Pro 14, which has been a big windfall for the IRFU, and they're sniffing around 15% of the Six Nations.
Yeah, it's a really interesting, really, rugby fans will be really interested in this in the Business Post, a double page spread. So it looks at who CVC are, you know, they're a Citicorp venture capital group and their involvement in Formula One, and now they're going after rugby in a big way. What's really interesting in it is some of the details on how little money is being made in rugby at the moment. And that's the one that incredibly me. That the company behind the Pro 14 shows it had a profit for 2018 of just £10,179, despite taking in £22.7 million in revenue. So there's a really strange imbalance going on already in rugby, and here we have people coming in to invest money, obviously to make money. Mm. And again, you watching everything that's happening in professional sport and in football in this case, it'll be really interesting to see how this pans out. And Eddie O'Sullivan is quoting it saying, is this money for growing the game and investing in it, or will it just be spent on salaries? Because if it's only spent on salaries, we were talking, you're looking back again to all these other sports and saying, where's the money going, and is it going to have a long-term effect, or is it just for people who want to make money?
The imbalance in rugby, that's to me, like, the top 5 clubs in France have a collective budget bigger than all of New Zealand rugby.
Yes.
It's incredible. And then, according to World Rugby itself, 80% of all the game's revenue comes from France and Britain, which I never knew either. It's so clearly the funding imbalance is...
Yeah. And it's a new, you know, it's a relatively new professional rugby. It's such new thing as well, you know.
I think it's at a more volatile stage now than it was in 95 when it turned professional. Like, the next decade for rugby is just going to change the landscape completely. There is a worry CVC want to get in there, get the pay-per-view rights for the Six Nations, make a ton of wedge that way, and maybe get out in 10 years. They're not overly worried. You could argue they may well deny this, and they're more than welcome to.
I was asking, is Six Nations protected under the EU directive?
Yeah, I think it's a B category, though, so you might have free-to-air highlights of an evening.
Okay.
Ah, okay.
All right, at all. Okay.
Yeah. And that would make sense then, because even if you look at... Because I would have thought, why aren't they making more money? And then you're thinking, well, maybe the TV rights are nothing in comparison, obviously, to other sports. But it's a good piece. It's as private equity's own in on rugby, should fans be worried? And it's well worth reading for a rugby fan.
Yeah, Neil Francis wrote a piece about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
The short answer to that question was very.
Yeah.
Just we don't know enough about their intentions.
Yeah.
They're suddenly, you know, people come in with big money, they're able to buy huge stakes in the sport.
Yeah.
And their motivation might not necessarily to make sure the next generation are taking up the game.
I'm sure the
South African story is not unconnected, I have no doubt.
That's exactly, and at that point it's made here as well.
And I was thinking that last week when that story came out, it was obviously the Cheetahs and Southern Kings was a sort of testing ground for South Africa to eventually come into Six Nations.
I wouldn't say the Cheetahs or Kings have really won hearts and minds up here. I mean, so anything anyone else wants to give a quick mention to?
No, I think so. There's a piece with Tyson Fury just to be, and kind of linking it in with Andy Lee in the Sunday Times, and obviously, you know, that's his fight coming up, and also I think just he's an interesting example in terms of mental health. I was watching him being interviewed on Sky during the week on one of these round table things as well, you know, and he's a man who has you know, got absolute gone up and down, and you just wonder about the difficulty of that sport, and what he's come through.
And he's helped him now, isn't he?
Yeah, and he's involved with him now. Yeah. So he needs good people in his corner.
Yeah, he would do.
Fellas, thanks so much to fellas. Me and you, the fellas. Thank you both for coming in. Mark Gallagher of the Irish Daily Mail and the Mail on Sunday, thank you. And as ever, Cliona Foley, a journalist, presents the Off the Bench podcast here as well as part of offtheball.com. Thank you. We'll be back next week looking through the Sunday papers.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation. The Six Nations Show on OTB Sports Radio.
The evolution of Ireland probably wasn't to the same degree over that period of time.
Updates, analysis and opinion across all OTB channels from start to finish.
I'm kind of sick of listening to them saying, oh, it's because they're the biggest playing pool in the world.
Go on, Ireland!
I've never seen a team like Ireland before.
This is OTB Sports Radio.
The Six Nations Show on OTB Sports Radio, Thursdays from 12.
We support the Irish.
OTB Sports Radio, live, online, 24/7 on the Go Loud app.